And tonight on Coast to Coast, we talk about exorcisms, demonic possession, the church and the paranormal. Charles Coulomb joins us, and we'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Charles Coulomb is a Catholic journalist, freelance writer, former contributing editor to the National Catholic Register, and has written several other journals as well. He did commentary on the last papal funeral conclave for ABC, Fox, and the BBC. He attended the New Mexico Military Institute in Roswell, New Mexico, and he has known such figures as James Francis Cardinal McIntyre, former Archbishop of Los Angeles, whom Charles Berlitz claimed saw the wrecked Roswell saucer, and the famed television psychic Criswell, and also Father Malachi Martin. Let's welcome Charles back to Coast to Coast. Hey, Charles, how are you, sir?
Very well indeed, George. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Geez, so many things have been going on this planet right now, the church as well, but can we keep up with all this, Charles? I mean, it doesn't seem to stop.
Well, I don't know that more is going on or that our means of finding out about it.
Well, that's true. That's true. Social networking and everything else has changed, I think, the face of this planet, hasn't it?
Well, it has. I mean, stop and think. It used to be you'd get up in the morning, you'd read your newspaper, in my case, say, the L.A. Times, and maybe people would call, you'd get letters, and so on and so forth. There's a certain amount of information. Now, you're immediately in touch with, as soon as you get on the Internet, you're immediately in touch with newspapers across the globe, friends you might have in any country of similar interests. I mean, it's certainly... It certainly is a very different world of the one you and I grew up in.
Sure is. We're going to talk a lot about the church and its view of the paranormal with demons and exorcisms. Religion overall these days, Charles, and you're an expert. You're one of the best out there. Is it all under fire? What's happening with it?
Well, a couple of things, I think. Number one, you do have a sort of huge marketplace of ideas wherein anything and everything can be found out. You're a Zoroastrian, you're a Jain, you're anything, your ideas are out there. And, of course, for a lot of us, from what would be a conventional background here in L.A., this is very intoxicating, right? L.A., I mean, the U.S., this is very intoxicating, this huge, expanded marketplace of ideas.
Sure.
But by the same token, more and more, the religious view of the world, of views, I should say, plural, the religious views of the world come ever more into conflict with those of our leading elites. And, well, historically, that always brews problems.
It sure does. It sure does. You've been doing this for a long time. How'd you get involved in all this? Doesn't decide to just specialize in being a great religious investigator. How did this happen?
Well, that's a good question. And the answer is... It didn't happen all at once. I've always had a tremendous interest both in my own religion, in comparative religions, and in the paranormal. My father, of course, was of French-Canadian descent, told us, in addition to the articles of our faith, told us all sorts of peculiar tales from our folklore and so on. When we moved out to California during my childhood, we ended up in the house, as you mentioned, of the famed TV psychic Criswell.
Yeah.
Which was a place that that dripped prophecy, let me tell you.
Sure.
Most of it not very good. He was, after all, the one who predicted that Mae West would be elected president in 1960.
Good prediction, right?
Yeah, it all came to pass. But by the same token, he did predict, and this is the only one of his many predictions that seems to have come true. He predicted that President Kennedy would not run again in 64 because of something that would happen to him in November of 63.
How about that?
So he did that on national television. So it was all always floating around, as you might say. But I would have to say that I fell into it more than anything else. I did a number of different things, most of which were of some interest to me, but none of which were really terribly satisfying. And then, in 1985, I wrote my first book. It was really intended for my classmates in Catholic high school. It was about basically why none of us went to Mass anymore, myself excepted. Well, from there, people started asking me to write about various things, usually religiously related, but not always. And before I knew it, the years had gone by, and suddenly I was a commentator.
Oh, you are one of the most sought-after religious experts in the world. Of course, you already know that.
Well, I'm afraid I really can't respond easily to that. I don't take compliments well, but thank you. I have to attribute a good piece of it to good management. My agent in New York, Jake Elwell, and my lecture agent here, Jerome McAllister, Anthony McAllister. It's one of those things. I mean, you know yourself, George, when you started out, you had no idea of where your career would go.
No, we really don't.
So many careers in life, you know if you're going to be an engineer, a scientist, because you train for them, there are things you have to do. But when you go into areas, whether it be media or religion or anything that's a bit out of the ordinary, you kind of have to find your own way, and we presume are guided in some sense.
Charles, the church fascinates me because so many billions of people follow the word of the Pope and what is happening, yet there is that segment there in the church and its views on the supernatural, the paranormal, extraterrestrials. And I want to get into that with you tonight. I mean, they own observatories, which I find very unusual, but they love science. So overall, your opinion, what's the church's perspective on the supernatural?
Well, there are two things one has to bear in mind. The first is that it would be truer to say that the church's perspective is supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, the Catholic view of reality is that it's very much like the iceberg, and what you see is only a small amount of what there is. The great church fathers and John Chrysostom said, if we could see things as they really are, we would faint dead away with fright. And that's kind of a radical thing to say at any age, even when he said it back in the 400s. But it's also important to bear in mind, though, that what Catholics are obligated to believe is, I won't say it's small, because there's a lot of radical things in it. The Trinity, the Incarnation, transubstantiation, those things are very radical. But when it comes to the question of what we call the paranormal in the secular world, there's very little that a Catholic is required to believe or disbelieve. That is to say, the Catholic is obligated to believe in a state called purgatory, wherein those who die after death and are not sufficiently perfect to go to heaven spend a period of purgation before being able to ascend, as it were. Now then, can someone leave this state of purgatory and appear on earth to the living? Many Catholics have said yes. Some say absolutely not. You're not required to believe either one. You're required to believe in purgatory. So you go from... You go from a question of what is the doctrine the Catholic is required to believe to what various Catholic teachers might have said and upon what basis. So in the very skeptical period that I grew up in the 60s and 70s, it was very, very common in the wake of Vatican II for a lot of noted Catholic theologians to scoff at things like, ghosts. And right. Angels and demons and so forth. I mean, they were required to believe in their actuality, but it's whether or not they did anything on this side of the veil. That was another question.
But that's changed now, hasn't it?
Well, it has, and oddly enough, especially as regards the demonic, that change, and this is very peculiar for an American because we're used to theological currents coming out of Europe. That change, to a great degree, began with The Exorcist.
The movie.
And I say this because just prior to its coming out, perhaps 1973, I think, the the Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is the theological watchdog body, as it were, in Rome, was forced to issue a paper affirming the reality of Satan. Because a lot of theologians, again, in the wake of the council, the excitement of the 60s, were saying, oh, there's no such being as Satan. Evil is simply a reflection of man's lack of perfection and so forth.
Right.
So the doctrine, as I recall, was coming under attack itself. There were even articles in things like Time Magazine and so on. Well, out comes The Exorcist a couple of years later. Now, what was interesting about The Exorcist, apart from its bizarre special effects, is that it was based upon an actual event.
That's right.
The little boy. The little boy. It wasn't a girl, and it wasn't quite the way he had it in the film, but it was a little boy. And the thing is, it did bring home practical realities. You see, I've said that the Catholic is required to believe in the devil. He is not required to believe in demonic possession, but the church's experience shows that it happens. And there you get into what's really kind of a fascinating area. There are all sorts of strange, odd, we would think, realities in the church. Demonic possessions, miraculous relics, all sorts of things, which really occur. They're indisputable if you sit down and examine them. But they really don't get a lot of press.
No, they don't. You're right about that.
No, I mean, you don't think of demonic possession in the same sense that you do the income tax.
No.
The one is a definite reality that you're going to have to deal with in a few months. The other, that's interesting.
Well, you know, the perception, there's some people out there, Charles, as you know, who no longer believe in a heaven or a hell. They just seem to think that we're out there, you know, we're doing their thing. I don't know if that's the case. I think there's got to be a place for souls to go from individuals who have been so bad in this life that they're not going to hang around with the good people, are they?
Well, they wouldn't want to, would they? I mean, The thing to bear in mind about heaven and hell is that they're monuments, as it were, to free will. You do decide where you're going to go. God sets up the rules, but you're the one who decides whether or not you're going to play by them. And I often remember when I was a kid, I'd hear various atheists of my acquaintance say to me, well, could your God create a rock so heavy he couldn't lift it? Maybe you've heard that one. And the thought just sort of jumped out of my mouth. Well, yes, and he did. It's called your free will. He can't make you say or do or think anything you don't really want to. And so you can be assured that if anyone in hell were taken out and put in heaven for a bit, they wouldn't be able to stand it.
No, we couldn't. I couldn't.
Well, think about it for a second. If hell is the reward, as it were, for refusing to do God's will, and heaven is the reward for doing it, you spent your whole existence not wanting it. Why would you want to go there afterwards?
That's true. Well, you know, when you were talking about exorcists and exorcisms, isn't the church, don't they have about 120 exorcists who've been trained to do battle with evil?
Well, more than that, it wasn't, again, one of the period when I was growing up was the 60s and 70s, so it was a little anomalous.
Right.
But most dioceses try to have a diocesan exorcist. Now, it's very important to bear in mind, though, that the church does insist that every other possibility be exhausted. It's not as with some Pentecostal groups and so on, where if someone is misbehaving, obviously they're possessed. Well, no. You've got to exhibit definite preternatural, as they say, preternatural phenomena. For instance, George, if you suddenly start speaking Latin and blaspheming in it, if holy water begins burning your skin, you get the idea.
Yeah.
It's got to be that level of certainty.
Does that happen, Charles?
Indeed, it does.
It does happen.
Yeah. It's, as I say, it's required. Unless there are a certain number of preternatural phenomena that are required to be present before the church will perform an exorcism. And everything else has to be exhausted. One of the things that was quite true about the movie was the insistence on the psychologist. If you said to me that so-and-so, it was not me, but if you came to your parish priest and you said, look, this fellow here is possessed, he's foaming at the mouth, he's bouncing off the walls, nothing but blasphemies, the priest will say first, well, you've been to a doctor.
Exactly.
And that's
probably the proper thing to say.
Well, of course. Of course yeah. It is, because it's important to bear in mind that while these things occur, they don't occur that often. And it's as with anything else in the realm of the unusual and the preternatural. 9 times out of 10, there's nothing to this or that particular case. But that 10th case, that could be the problem.
That's the Holy Grail, basically.
Exactly. And or the unholy grail in this case. The thing is that the whole system of that the church employs does require that everything else be exhausted. And it's, if you will, it's almost the reverse of the canonization of a saint, where basically everything is exhausted to prove that he wasn't a saint.
That's right.
And only getting through the most rigorous review of the individual's life, the requisite number of miracles, all sorts of things of that nature, only then will an individual be raised to the church's altars. So it's important to bear in mind that, especially because the church believes herself to be in possession of spiritual truth, she's got to be very, very careful.
Well, and as you've said, Charles, of the 10 people that seem to be possessed, let's say 9 of them are suffering from some emotional disorder, some kind of problem, some physical ailment, but that one person, that very one person truly is demonically possessed, what does that tell you about why and how?
Well, obviously, there's a lot we don't know. In this area, it's not as though it came with a fully filled out guidebook. What we do have are centuries of experience on the part of exorcists. So what's actually happened?
Right.
But bear in mind, there are a few references in the Bible, there are a number of writings of the saints and things of this nature. But it's not as though there were a handy dandy guidebook somewhere that explains it all for you. However, there are a few things that the experience of exorcists and the church in general down through the centuries would seem to indicate. One, opening oneself up to sort of willy-nilly to the supernatural, the preternatural, as it were, calling things into oneself, as it were, is a good way to have trouble.
Well, it's a huge... Charles, hold on for a second. We're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Our special guest throughout the night tonight, noted expert and religious writer Charles Coulomb. We're going to be talking about demons, UFOs, ghosts, vampires, witchcraft, you name it. We've got it tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And we've got a new website set up for you for our television program, Beyond Belief. You can watch it for 10 days free. Simply go to beyondbelief.com. That's it. Made it very easy for you. Take a look at that. You can also have access to all these other incredible videos that are there for the 10 days. Beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast, Charles Coulomb with us. You can find his Facebook link at coasttocoastam.com. Charles, are there any case studies for us here with regards to the church and exorcists?
Well, there are several different, how do I put this? There are several different fairly well-known exorcists today. Father Amorth, of course, who was the exorcist of the Diocese of Rome and is probably the best known today. There are several in Spain and other places who write accounts of what they've done. And of course, there's the very famous book by my late friend Malachi Martin, Hostage to the Devil.
That's right.
Which, doing the research of, for which, of course, played a huge part in changing his life. Because you may recall that I mentioned that in the earlier part of the 70s, late 60s, was a great deal of doubt cast on the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in those days, Father Martin was one of those doubt casters. He was a very modernist, as we should say, a theologian. But when he decided to write the book, it was intended to debunk the whole question of exorcisms. And what he found was that it was all true.
It changed him, didn't it?
Well, yeah. It began changing him from, well, what he had been, which he, I have to say, was not too terribly proud of, to what he became, which was a much more, shall we say, doctrinally aware Catholic priest. And that, you see, is one of the values of this sort of thing, and it does have a value. It reminds us that our religion is not simply a set of intellectual principles that we have to hold, though of course it is that. It is, in fact, an entire view of reality. And although you are not required to believe in these sorts of things, you're not required to believe in the existence of Europe either. You know, you could be as blissfully ignorant as you like, and that's okay. But one thing the church does do, because of its experience with exorcisms and demonic activity, is that whether or not you believe in, shall we say, the easy access of the demonic to our world, nevertheless, whatever you believe as a Catholic, you're forbidden to play with Ouija boards. You're forbidden to go to seances. You're forbidden to do anything that in the traditional view of things would open your door, so to speak. And similarly, anything like trance channeling, like, the sort of voodoo practice of opening yourself up to one of their gods to be ridden as a horse, all of that would be looked on with severe disfavor by the church, because you're giving up your will yourself to something outside.
Why are they so strict, Charles? Why is the church so strict?
Experience. Sheer experience. I mean, remember, the church has been dealing with God, man, and the demonic for a little under 2,000 years. It's not like she doesn't know what cooks.
Right.
If you look at the examples of exorcism, some of them, frankly, there's no way of knowing how the demon got in. It just isn't. But very often, it was through one of these practices. Now, mind you, that doesn't mean that if you look at a Ouija board in the toy shop, you're suddenly going to start swiveling your head around and vomiting guacamole. But but it does mean that certain people, for whatever reason, and again, we do not know the particulars. We only know that it happens.
Well, when
sorry,
when Malachi Martin, for example, changed, how did the church react to him? With favor or disfavor?
Well, disfavor, because, to be brutally frank, a great many churchmen shared his previous views, and many of them were people in power. Certainly, there had been a widespread movement to change the way the church believed and did things. You can trace this all the way back, really, to the early part of the 20th century, late part of the 19th, with a movement called modernism, which taught that rather than having a set of immutable truths given to her by Christ, the church was simply an expression of religiosity and had to evolve as mankind evolved. Well, unfortunately, while that is in some ways a very alluring idea and certainly makes life easier, it also is not true. So St. Pius X, who was the Pope at that time, reacted very furiously and condemned it. But although he condemned it, it didn't go away. And after World War II, when, especially in Europe, when, shall we say, Catholic confidence in the Catholic thing, if not necessarily in their doctrines, was somewhat shaken by the horrors they'd gone through. Well, let's just say that modernism underwent a resurgence. Now, Father Martin was of the opinion that there was a very carefully crafted conspiracy to transform the church into something strange and un-Catholic. Other people would disagree and would say that it was simply the current of the times. Whichever you care to believe, the results are the same. And certainly, it's a struggle that from the time of the council to the present has been pretty marked. Things certainly seem to settle down a great deal under Pope Benedict. Today, well, we're still early in the pontificate. It's hard to see where things are going. But Father Martin was very much a part of that. And he certainly was a progressor at Vatican II. And he felt extremely guilty, I think, about the role he had played then.
He apparently died of a brain hemorrhage. I've always wanted to ask somebody this, and you might know. That he apparently fell in his apartment in New York. It still is unsolved. Do you think something happened to him? Do you think he was killed, or do you think it was just an accident?
Well, I'll tell you, like the church with exorcism, I feel this way about conspiracies. They exist, but I'll exhaust every possible alternative first.
Sure.
So, you'd have to ask yourself if it was foul play. Who stood to benefit? Were his books such a threat to the status quo that he had to be rubbed out? Well, I don't know. If I did, I suppose I'd be part of it. But personally speaking, unless some other proof comes along, I suspect that it was what it was claimed to be, which was an accident. Because, he was an older man, and he... these things happen. Sure. Do I completely cut out the possibility? No, of course not.
I mean, did he ever share with you before his death, they're out to get me or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
No, he certainly referred to dark forces and conspiracies, but he never, to my knowledge, and there might have been others who knew him better than I did who think differently, but he never seemed personally concerned about his own safety. And I can tell you, he, as long as he could physically, he was a great one for making personal appearances, for traveling around. Oh, yeah. He even did coast to coast.
Yes, he sure did, many times.
Yeah, and these are not the actions of a frightened man. Now, whether he did see some threat, but felt that it was better to tell the truth than die a martyr, or whether he simply didn't feel afraid of any danger, I don't know. I can tell you one thing about Malachi Martin, though, which a lot of people don't know. He was a great one for secret charities. And I can think one particular case of a kid he put through college without ever having met before or after.
Good for him.
Yeah. Well, he had a good deal of money to spend, you say, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the side of him that I don't think people really appreciate.
As a Catholic journalist, did you ever come across the stories of the Third Secret of Fatima and exactly what that might be? There are some people, Charles, that claim, there's something horrendous out there that the church has never disclosed. And others simply say, no, they've already told us. Where do you stand on that?
Well, the thing is that I've never read The Third Secret of Fatima myself, so I'm not going to pretend that I know other than what I've been told from this source and that. It was supposed to have been revealed early on, 1960, and it wasn't. That by itself was probably a tremendous mistake.
Is it still a secret? Publicly?
Allegedly, no.
Okay.
Because a few years ago, under John Paul II, what was held to be the third secret of Fatima was in fact published. There was a theological commentary on it by Cardinal Ratzinger, who became Benedict XVI. And at the time, there was a great deal of speculation that this was not the third secret, or it wasn't all of it, because it was a horrendous but possibly symbolic vision of a pope moving through a devastated scene, which was not what people were looking for. You know, people really, really want out of prophecy specifics.
They do want specifics. You know, is this end times or something's going to happen?
Precisely.
And we want something big. You know, we don't want, the consecration of Russia is not exciting to people.
No, not at all. Let alone performing the duties of your state in life.
Exactly.
I mean, who wants to do that? Me least of all.
But so true.
It is certainly true that what was revealed at Fatima, the first and second secrets, were quite amazing, as opposed to my friend Criswell's predictions, which were very exact and very inaccurate. I shouldn't say that on the radio. They were perhaps differently accurate. But the thing is that at Fatima, it was very clear, the first and second secrets. She says that this war will end, but if people do not straighten up and fly right, another and worse will break out in the reign of Pope Pius XI.
Well, that was accurate.
That was accurate.
Well, what do you think the third secret is?
Well, I can't tell, of course, but I would suspect that it would have to do with, as we see, you know, the Church since the Second World War has gone through a great deal of trouble. There's been a crisis in faith, and this isn't just me saying this. When Pope Benedict XVI says that the vast majority of Catholics are liturgically illiterate, that's not being nice. It's true, but it's not nice. Most Catholics today do not know their faith. A great many of the clergy, though not, thank God, all by any means, do not believe in it. And certainly the great powers of the world are more openly against it than has been the case in quite a while. So I would suppose that the third secret would refer to that. And certainly what was issued as the third secret can be interpreted as referring to all that. I mean, let's put this another way. It seems to me, from what I've studied of prophecy, that most of it, Fatima was very unusual because there you had narrative, but most seers and saints who see things in the future do exactly that. They see. No narrative provided.
Right.
So, for instance, Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich, the stigmatic lady in Germany in early 19th century, she foresaw a future time when there would be black boxes in every house out of which Satan would speak. Now,
well, it could either be the radio or the TV. I'm not sure, right?
Well, it could have been. Now, imagine that she had a vision of a typical family of today watching Miley Cyrus's performance on TV.
That's right.
Bearing in mind that she's a little German nun in the early 19th century.
Yeah, yeah.
So is this precisely what she said? Is Satan directly speaking through the boxes? Well, it would certainly look that way to her. And given a lot of what we pick up, I would be the last one to say she was wrong. But perhaps she was not right the way it seemed. Well, the reason why I bring this up is because in thinking of the third secret, if it was in fact visual and not accompanied by narration like the first and second were, then, of course, it becomes very, very much open to interpretation. Now, last night, I was at a solemn high requiem in memoriam of my late father, who died back in 96.
Sorry to hear that.
It was what they call the extraordinary form now, what people used to call the Tridentine Mass. And it was at Blessed Sacrament Church in Hollywood, California. First time there'd been anything like that since the 60s. And one of the things that ran through my mind as I worshiped there was what strange, peculiar things have happened between the last time that sort of a mass was offered there and today. Now imagine, if you will, that the children of Fatima had a vision of the church as it is today in most places. They'd be horrified.
Oh, they would be. They wouldn't be able to understand it.
No. They'd be, and in that, they might have a much deeper insight into it than we live in it do. Just as perhaps Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich, without really knowing what she was seeing, might have understood it a little better than we do.
That's true.
And that's kind of a sobering thought. But you look back in history, and you know very well that people who lived during various historical times have often not really caught at all the significance of what they're living through while they're doing it.
No. And every civilization, Charles,
yeah,
believes that they are in the end times. Every civilization
Absolutely.
Has believed that.
Absolutely. And it's an easy assumption to make, because let's face it, civilizations do decline. And while it may not be the end of the world as in exploding like planet Krypton, it can certainly be the end of that civilization.
That's right.
I remember Cardinal McIntyre, who you referred to earlier, he, and there's pure coincidence, by the way, that he supposedly saw the flying saucer at Roswell.
Do you believe he did?
No, I don't. The reason why I don't believe it is because I forget the precise week, but the week that Berlitz assigned for him to have seen it was Holy Week of that year. And when it's very unlikely that he would have gone all the way out to Edwards Air Force Base. And to add a little more to it, his appointment books are still survive from that precise time.
Ah.
And they exist today in the LA Archdiocese and Archives. So I don't believe it simply because the idea of him going anywhere during Holy Week is madness. And we know exactly where he was because we have his appointment book. But I digress. That claim and my having gone to college in Roswell, strict coincidence. I have to emphasize this.
There are no coincidences.
Oh, all right, fine. Now you know. NMMI was taken over by aliens in 1948. There, I've told it. But at least my brother says you would think that from our graduates. But anyway, seriously speaking, The thing he told me in this era, because he was my confessor when I was in high school, and that's in the 70s. He was retired then. So at that time, you had things like Hal Lindsey's Late Great Planet Earth and all that kind of thing. Yeah. So I was, I don't know, 14 or 15, and I asked him one day what he thought of it. And he said something that, from that day to this, has kind of taken a little bit of the fear factor out. He said, I don't know when the end of the world is coming. It's going to come. One day the world will end. Dies irae, dies illa. But it very likely will not happen in your time or mine. But what will happen is that you and I are going to die. Our world will end.
That we know. We're going to come back in a moment, Charles. Lots more to talk with you about. I want to get into the church's views on extraterrestrial life and tell us, why do they own observatories? I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.